Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. This is going to be a big one, a heavy one today. Our community's been really struggling right now with the potential changes and uncertainty in the school setting. You know, everybody's talking about it. Many of us are really immersed in the schools with our children and aren't sure what the next few months and years are going to bring. And today I am joined by Kuna Tavlin, a senior policy and advocacy advisor with the Council of Exceptional Children. She may not have a crystal ball to predict our future in this world, but she can explain what is and isn't happening right now and what changes are being discussed at this time. There is so much confusion, and thank you so much for being here and bringing some truth to all this misinformation we're reading out there. The internet is not making this any easier, right? Well, welcome, Kuna. I think a good place to start would be to just kind of introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work that you do historically before all of this confusion started off.
Thanks, Marcy. And I just want to start by saying it has been such a pleasure to get to know you and to learn more about mitochondrial disease over the last few weeks. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. There is a lot of confusion, and I hope I can provide some clarity. I will not have all the answers. So a little bit about myself. I have been working in policy and advocacy for a little more than two decades. I started as a staffer on Capitol Hill, and my first job off of Capitol Hill was at a disability rights organization. And from there, I've really moved into the school setting and really kind of policy that impacts the well-being of children and families. I am a lobbyist, so I wear that scarlet letter, but I wear it with pride, and I'm like Linda the Good Witch. I do good work.
Good example, especially right now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It can be very jarring to hear that I am a lobbyist mm-hmm. statement for folks who aren't in my kind of professional sphere. I think it always usually elicits a gasp, but it just means that I talk with Congress and the administration about the special ed laws and other laws that impact people with disabilities. I am not a lawyer. Lawyers always say they're not giving legal advice. I am a non-lawyer saying I am not giving any legal advice.
But you're really here to tell us what's going on and what you've learned and what you see happening and how to help make some sense of this for our families out there that are really immersed in some of these confusing issues.
Exactly.
So I guess let's kind of start at the beginning. Can you explain what the Department of Education actually does as an entity? Why was it created and its overall purpose maybe prior to January?
Yes. And I'm glad that you asked that question because I think a lot of folks really don't know why the Department of Education exists, which certainly provides some risks for the future existence of the department, right? So I'm going to answer your question in reverse order. I'm going to talk about why it was created and then what it actually does. So it was created at the end of the Carter administration by an act of Congress. And that is important because it can only be dismantled by an act of Congress.
Right.
It's one of these legal rules. But
I think
I'm
that's
a non-lawyer,
big nugget.
But that's a thing.
I think that's a big nugget for our listeners to hear that like it can't just be dismantled on its own. Like it will take an act of Congress. Yes.
Exactly. And there are a lot of caveats that we'll talk about in a few minutes. But at the time, the law passed in 1979, the department was stood up in 1980. At that time, what we now know as the Health and Human Services Department was the Health, Education, and Welfare Agency. And the idea was to isolate education, pull it out so that there could be a greater focus on education. Some of the purposes of that law that established the department were to make sure that everybody in our country had an equal chance to get a good education. Now, this is at a time when the IDEA law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, was still pretty young. It was about five. It was going into kindergarten, if you will. Also, so that the department could serve as kind of a key part of the discussion of how to improve education alongside schools, businesses, research, parents, students, other kind of community-based stakeholders, et cetera. It was also intended to get more people involved in federal education programs, so using those programs, right? To emphasize education. And then also to collect and support data and research, again, to inform and improve the field. And so those were the real reasons. And then there's like kind of more technical, boring stuff about accountability and transparency that I don't think really matters anymore. It's like, but like the visionary purpose, right, was to emphasize and really improve education nationwide. What it actually does, the department has four core functions, and those are the distribution of federal funds. You'll see it called federal aid or financial aid. That's not just like grants and loans for college. That also includes all of the special education funds and Title I, which is a formula program based on poverty. Those funds, one of those key functions of the department is to distribute those funds. There's also oversight components of that. Also gathering data on schools and sharing research findings, right? So that information and research component. Also examining trends, highlighting pressing issues, and proposing, not making, proposing reforms to Congress. And then the last one, which is really key to our kind of joint field, which is enforcing anti-discrimination laws and promoting equal access to education, right? That strong civil rights component. I also think it's really important to know what the department does not do.
Tell us.
It does not mandate curriculum. So there is a lot of conversation about state and local control of education. The Department of Education does not decide what is taught in your kid's school. That is not in their jurisdiction. It is a bipartisan consensus that that is not an appropriate role for the federal agency.
Got it. Well, let it be heard. Now, a big question is, you know, as we alluded to earlier, you know, people are talking about, will the Department of Education be disbanded? Or is that in the works?
Yes and no. So it's a little bit complicated, and I think this is the most pressing question. And the ones that will follow, like the follow-up questions to this question, are all really dependent on what does end up happening. So the federal agency itself cannot self-destruct, self-shut down, right?
Good to know.
But it is a stated priority of the Trump administration and of Education Secretary Linda McMahon. And there was a recent executive order to do just that. But within that executive order signed by the president at the White House, it does note that the actual closing of the department is up to Congress, right? So there is a public acknowledgement that Congress needs to take that action. However, there's also some public confusion. For example, the week that the president signed the executive order, he said in an interview, I believe in the Oval Office, that, oh, yes, we're moving special education, and I say, quote unquote, back to the Health and Human Services Department. Now, when I was talking a minute ago about the creation of the Department of Education, it did not come out of the Health and Human Services Department. It was a different department at the time, right? It had different core functions. So it's not like it peeled off and it goes back in. And also, that was where all education programs were held, not just special education, right? But because the president said, yeah, we're moving it back, we already have it worked out, it implied that it was a done deal. But again, it needs an act of Congress. Mm-hmm. So that was a confusing week.
Yeah.
That was a confusing week for our members who are professionals in the special ed field. That was certainly a confusing week for parents.
For sure.
Really just confusing.
Well, when you hear the president say something, you know, you tend to believe
his ability to do something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not all of us just finished a course in government, you know?
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It's good politics, right? I often yeah. say things and then hope they come into, you know, right. into being.
Right. Right.
But again, the accuracy and the gravitas of those statements, right, certainly did cause
it confusion. Created a tornado.
Absolutely. And I still feel like we're kind of trying to straighten that out there. I still encounter regularly people who still are confused about whether it's happening or not. Now, there are more answers to the question about whether the department is currently being disbanded, because technically, no. But the workforce has been cut in half
right,
already.
Right. And they can only do so much. So even if they're still mm-hmm. existing and they've let so many people go, programs are going to suffer.
Exactly. And we're already starting to see, I wouldn't say suffering necessarily in the IDEA space, but certainly concerns about the delays in and timing of the department's functions around
yeah.
IDEA, around civil rights enforcement. That has been hampered significantly. There used to be 12 field offices, and those were the offices where if you had a civil rights complaint, you would go to that office, call them to lodge your complaint. There were 12, now there are 5.
Wow.
And the staff have been let go in alarming numbers. And that really hampers the enforceability of civil rights. And a little over a third of those Office for Civil Rights complaints are disability related. So this is a really core function of oversight and accountability and civil rights, frankly, for the disability community in the education context. So that's really challenging. And there
that's
are a lot
scary.
Of other areas. Yeah, there are a lot of other areas where we've seen cuts. I think the department has been pretty careful not to make or tried not to make devastating cuts to disability-related programs, but have done so anyway. For example, they've preserved the National Center for Special Education Research, but almost every other part of the federal independent research branch of the Department of Education seems to have been shut down. And there were an alarming number of research grants that were canceled. Only one is in the disability space, but that certainly has a really negative ripple effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then we, you know, 2 weeks ago, there was a cancellation of about 2/3 of the mental health professional development grants that were designed to get more mental health professionals into school settings. Those, you know, a lot of those grants were more than halfway through their grant period, and just really putting more personnel in school, which is a huge need.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we saw also the cancellation of teacher preparation grants. Again, not the special ed specific ones,
mm-hmm.
but some that were, for example, doing really rich local work, for example, credentialing folks who are working in local schools as paraeducators to become special educators,
mm.
right? So some really important work that has been canceled. We're not sure what's going to happen with all of those cancellations, but again, it's like the department hasn't shut down, but we're definitely feeling a squeeze.
Yeah.
And there aren't any answers about how the current funding year is going to kind of play out in some of these programs. So that's another big question. And with limited staff, it's very hard to get answers.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's just slowing everything down. Is the Department of Education's responsibility to hold states accountable to equal access services through Title I and the IEPs and 504s?
Yes, absolutely. The Office for Special Education Programs and the Office for Civil Rights play a huge role in that. In terms of accountability and support, really, you see a mix of funding, right? The distribution of that financial aid, regulations, which will require states and LEAs, local educational agencies, to comply with law in certain manners, and then actually enforcement to guarantee equitable access for all students, including those with disabilities. And so the enforcement comes in a variety
yeah.
of ways. From the Office of Civil Rights, often a district or a state will have to go into some kind of a resolution agreement to remedy wrongdoings. When it comes to IDEA oversight, it's a little more tricky because the measures are punitive, and so ultimately they harm students more. So what I mean is the department has the ability to withhold funds from IDEA, but they don't tend to do that because they don't want that to be the outcome for students.
Got it. Okay. So how does the Department of Education support accommodations in the college setting? Just kind of switching gears for a minute.
It's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it so that I could at least clarify that the first answer really is in the context of K-12 education.
Okay.
For colleges, it's a different story. There is no IDEA at the college level. There's no IEP, but that doesn't mean that kids don't transition from high school to youth, from high school to college with disabilities, right? And so the colleges that do receive federal aid are required to provide what's called reasonable accommodations. That's a phrase that may sound really familiar to folks. And the department provides guidance on what reasonable accommodations may be. So, I mean, I can think of a few, like arranging for priority registration, reducing a course load, substituting one course requirement for another, and then some additional kind of day-to-day accommodations like providing a scribe or a note taker, allowing recording devices, having sign language interpreters in the classroom, or extended time for testing, right? Those kinds of things. The idea is that the reasonable accommodations don't take away from the rigor of the academics, but they provide access. But there is no FAPE requirement, that requirement under 504 and IDEA that requires a free and appropriate public education. That doesn't exist in the college environment either. So it's different. Another thing that's challenging, I could talk forever, so cut me off if I'm going down into higher ed.
No, I think it's really important to learn about. And I think our families are really interested in what is actually going on instead of what you can easily read on, you know, news sites that are possibly not accurate.
So I think one of the biggest changes when you go from the K-12 and early childhood setting to higher ed is that the onus is on the person with the disability to self-report and to seek accommodations and academic adjustments.
That's probably a lot harder for some kids than others.
Big vibe switch.
Yeah.
Right. And because if they're not entitled to those things, if they don't self-report, many students just don't want to self-report and don't receive those reasonable accommodations, but some do. And every college is different in the way that they are able to provide support. But there's usually a disability office on a college campus that can provide some support. Again, the capacity is really wide ranging.
There's so many obstacles in a child's life, and then factoring all of these things in it as well. It's really scary to hear, and that a lot of this is up in the air, and, you know, funding could be lost and staff is reduced, and, you know, things feel slow as it is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think my biggest panic about education is that when the processes are slow, it's really damaging because the kids do not stop growing. They don't stop aging,
they
right?
Need so for it me, today.
It's an emergency.
Yeah. And for the parents, you know, this is their child.
Absolutely. Oh, and I'm a mother too.
Right.
It just makes my chest tighten to think about delaying any kinds of services for a kid.
Yeah. Anymore. So let's say my child has an IEP or 504 plan. So on a micro level, how would a reduction in funding for the Department of Education impact my child?
Yeah.
So in a more individual way, who would enforce the IEP?
It's a good question. I would say not a reduction in funding, but a reduction in capacity.
I think that's a better word. Yes.
Yeah. And we'll talk about funding later. That's one of my favorite things to talk about. It's something I talk about a lot. I want to stress that IDEA and Section 504 are federal laws, right? And so ultimately, the oversight is at the federal level. It's a federal government function. But there are a lot of layers to that enforcement before you kind of get to the Fed, which is kind of the nuclear option, right? So establishment and enforcement of the IEP is designed to be as local as possible.
Right.
Inside the school building.
Inside the school.
Family. Yes. And the kid, if appropriate and desired, right? So in terms of enforcement, I think it's also designed to be from starting at the local level and moving outward. So that wouldn't necessarily change in terms of like the chain of disputing something that is not being implemented, right? So the Department of Education is not directly enforcing your child's 504 plan or IEP. They're just not. And they shouldn't. And they would never have that kind of capacity. Mm-hmm. And they don't know your kids.
Right.
So you don't want them to.
Right.
I don't want
right.
them to. So in that local control yeah. argument, that is happening at the local level, right?
So that's good because that should mean yeah. hopefully no change.
Yeah. However, we say in Washington, D.C. more and more that a law is only as good as its enforcement, and that can have a negative trickle-down effect if that ultimate kind of enforcement layer is weakened.
Right, right. right.
So, you know, even though the department isn't enforcing your child's plan, they are getting reports from states based on reporting from districts, based on reporting from schools. They look at their data. They see what's trending. They provide interventions in areas that are struggling. So the department really is that looming authority. So in an instance that capacity is diminished or eliminated, it will certainly have a trickle down or a
yeah.
ripple effect.
Yeah.
And I do want to say, though, that I don't think schools and school personnel, which I represent, are trying to skirt IEPs and 504s. Usually when those disputes do happen, it's a capacity problem, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think that it's possible that the implementation would weaken, but I don't think it's what practitioners would want to do, if that
mm-hmm.
makes sense,
mm-hmm.
right?
Got it. Has there been any discussion about the family having to cover services or the insurance company covering these types of services? I know that's always a worry.
I feel like that would be, if I was a parent watching kind of the news and maybe social media about what's happening at the federal level with the Department of Education, that would be my top worry,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm going to have to pick up the tab.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say really briefly, no, in my circles, I have not heard okay. any conversations
Good.
About
Good.
Parents picking up the tab for services provided on a 504 plan or an IEP as a resolution to decreasing the federal role. Now, I do want to also acknowledge that there are probably a lot of parents out there that are spending a good amount of their own money on services and supports that the school is not providing. So it's not that that's impossible, but that's not a requirement, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's good news. That's good news. So the next question is really coming from directly from some of our parents in the Meadow Action community. And I want to read it word for word because it's not a world that I live in as much. And so I want to make sure that their question is really asked well. You know, let's say a child has a 504 plan due to their medical condition, but they would not qualify for an IEP because they don't have a cognitive delay. They need accommodations based on medical condition only. So let's say an accommodation is that she gets extended time to complete assignments when they've been out sick. Unfortunately, there are consistent issues with teachers, and this might predate our current administration. There have been issues with teachers not following that accommodation. So who is supposed to enforce the accommodations if 504 plans are governed by the Rehabilitation Act and the IEPs by the Disability Education Act? Is one or the other more or less enforceable?
They are both enforceable because they are both federal laws. And the department will enforce Section 504 through the Office for Civil Rights. But I wouldn't start there. I would start at the school.
Okay.
Because a 504 plan is a legally binding document between the family and the school. And so if it is not being followed, the first thing to do is to raise the flag to the person who's supposed to be implementing the plan and whoever their supervisor is who is ensuring compliance, right? And I would start my email with, this service is not being provided. Here's a copy of my 504 plan. This is a violation of our contract. We need to talk now, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not just a hypothetical. I actually have a good friend whose son has really extreme allergies and whose teacher had not taken the allergy awareness module that was required in his 504 plan to ensure safety in the classroom. He's little. And she still hadn't by November. And my friend was getting really agitated. And I dictated a very similar email to her that started with, this is a violation of Section 504. Here's our contract. This needs to be remedied immediately. I need you to show me a plan. And after being ignored by the teacher for quite some time, the principal wrote her back within minutes.
Wow.
Because this is not the kind of issue that you want to go up the chain. Mm-hmm. If it turns into a lawsuit, the district stands to lose a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
That school districts don't have money to spend.
Right.
This is the kind of thing that will be taken very seriously at the administrative level. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I want to acknowledge our audience, and I'm sure that some people who are listening are saying, yeah, well, we tried that and our school doesn't X, Y, Z, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a formal process for moving that up the chain if the school isn't helping to the district level, to the Office for Civil Rights. Anyone can file a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, although I recommend that not as a first step in any
especially right now, especially with the capacity. To 12 to 5.
Yes, exactly. But there's a formal process for that. And there is a kind of a priority enforcement between 504 and IEP. They're both laws. They both need to be enforced. So.
Okay. That's good to hear. Hopefully that'll help some of our families out there. So let's say the funding, we're talking a year or two, I hope this doesn't happen, but let's say the funding is reduced for IEPs through the Department of Education. How often would that be evaluated to kind of recognize the harm that it's doing and going back to what it is or what it was?
All right. I'm excited because now we're talking about the money.
This is your wheelhouse.
Yes. This is the one I talk about the most. So first of all, great question. Definitely, I think, represents a lot of folks' fears. Mm-hmm. I want to just clarify at the beginning that the funding doesn't go to IEPs. The bulk of funding goes to states through a formula, not based on anybody's decision making, but through a formula that's in the law. And then states distribute it to districts. That is called the Grants to States program under IDEA. Big shocker. Real creativity, I know. That funding is spent in a variety of ways. So I'm going to, off the top of my head, list a few of the allowable uses of that IDEA funding. The biggest expenditures, and I think the most helpful, frankly, in most cases, hopefully, it's special education teachers and paraeducators and other specialized instructional support personnel. That's like our technical term, but that's audiologists, PT, OT, SLPs, right? The folks who are the non-teachers, non-paraeducators who help implement an IEP or a 504 plan. And in addition to personnel, it's also specialized equipment, assistive technology, like accessible playground equipment, some extended school year services. Those are the kinds of expenditures. So that is what IDEA funding is spent on. For the big grants to states program, there's also child client activities, so identification of people with disabilities. This funding, the question is, how often is it evaluated, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Every single year, which is why I talk about this so much. Every year, as part of the Congress's proverbial power of the purse, they have to make decisions about the funding levels for programs at every federal agency, including the Department of Education, which is where IDEA lives. And so annually, they decide how much to put toward that program. Now, we are right now in the thick of that budget process. Congress is evaluating spending for next fiscal year, which starts on October 1st. The president has provided kind of a sketch of a budget that will be more fleshed out in the coming weeks, probably. And that does include IDEA. In terms of funding, the budget proposal that we have seen, which is pretty light on details and only has 4 sentences on IDEA, but it does say that it will deliver on the president's promise to preserve special education funding, which is good. There are a lot of education programs that they pledged to cut, but not this one.
Okay.
So, yeah. We don't know what the out years will look like, and we don't know what the details of the budget will look like.
Right.
But it does sound like there is not an appetite to cut funding. And we've been talking a lot about the functions of the department, and now we're talking about the funding. And I do want to emphasize that they go hand in glove, right? Again, because a law is only as good as its enforcement.
For sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Definitely also needs to be well-funded. And even though we're not looking at a cut, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that Congress has within the IDEA law pledged to fund up to 40% of what's estimated to be the excess cost to educate a person with a disability. And right now they're providing about 10% of that excess cost. So they're nowhere near the funding level that was intended when the bill was designed. So they're not funding the bill the way that it was designed to be implemented, but it's being implemented nevertheless. So needless to say, if you're wondering why there are challenges, there are certainly some solid reasons.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack right there. If we wanted to make
this a
2-hour episode, right? I'm sure you could talk at length just about that. So let's say you have a child that is in the schools right now. They have a 504 plan. They have an IEP. What should we do to advocate for our child's needs right now? If there's a problem, you know, we talked about how they can advocate. Is there anything else they should be doing? What could they be doing to advocate for their kid?
I love advocacy, and it takes so many different shapes and forms, right? So I work on federal policy and advocacy on the Council for Exceptional Children website, exceptionalchildren.org. Sorry for the plug, but I have to. We have a legislative action center where anybody, any member of the public can go and take a look at our action alerts, and it just automatically sends a message to Congress. One of the top ones is to fund all of the parts of IDEA. I think that's really important this year because we don't know what the details of the budget will look like. So that's kind of a simple way to
do. We'll put that in the show notes so that our listeners can go ahead and do that on their own.
So there's grassroots advocacy toward lawmakers, but there are also a lot of other ways to advocate, right? And it depends on what your frame is and what you really want to advocate for. But I'll say, I'm going to guess that most of these listeners are already advocates for their children.
Very true. Very true. I don't think they're sitting around not doing anything. But what is necessary right now in this environment that we're living in?
I think making it clear, if your position is that the federal laws that support kids with disabilities in the school context are important, making that known, making it known that the functions of the Department of Education help kids with disabilities in a really big way. And I think it's a roll of the dice to leave it up to states. Before IDEA was enacted, 1 in 5 kids with a disability was educated in a public school.
Wow.
And I know that we're not 50 years ago. We are a different country. But one of the things that kind of scares me is that we are part of a generation that doesn't know what it looks like to turn kids away from school, right? And so I think it's really important to advocate about the importance of being educated in schools and that that's a right, because we take it for granted. And so we don't advocate for that. And so I think it could leave us vulnerable at very short notice, honestly, because it's not, we're not rallied around it the way that I think we were 50 years ago when the law was enacted. I think advocacy also, it's not just about talking to elected officials, but it's about talking to your family, talking to your friends, talking to your community, making sure that everyone understands what's going on and what's important to you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially because this is a little bit of a niche issue. The context of educating people with disabilities in schools is not something that folks really understand unless they are impacted by it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think advocacy is about spreading the word, spreading experiences, spreading, talking about stories. And there may be opportunities to do more formal advocacy toward elected officials. You know, you can always go to a town hall and express concerns. You can always write a letter to your elected officials or make a phone call or ask for a meeting. And you may be surprised at how actually accessible folks are, especially if you're a constituent because you're their voting base, right?
Right, right.
And so that matters. Yeah. So I would think about advocacy as a broad spectrum of activities and think about it really as putting forward a message.
Okay. That's a good way to leave it. But we'll make sure that that page, a specific link to that portion of your page will be on our show notes. You've been so powerful in your word, and I have really enjoyed learning from you. Thank you so much for taking the time to hopefully clear some of this up for our families. It's so important to really get the right information right now and not be mired down in things that aren't necessarily even accurate.
Well, it was my sincere, Marcy, sincere pleasure to spend this time with you and to
Thank
talk
you.
About a topic that is so important.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And maybe we'll get an update from you in a couple months or down the road. But you do incredible work. And thank you so much for everything that you do and the work you do.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.